civilized tribes, in part because they developed codes of law and judicial systems, but also because they readily adopted the European customs of running plantations, slaveholding, and raising cattle. They also often intermarried with Europeans. However, despite European admiration for the Southeast tribes' abilities to adapt, these Native Americans were still exploited, exterminated, or evacuated. De-stereotyping the Native Americans. Both historians and Hollywood have often stereotyped pre-Columbian Native Americans as either noble people who lived in constant harmony with nature, or mindless knuckleheads who sat around in the dirt when they weren't brutally killing one another. The truth is somewhere in between. Like people everywhere else, Native Americans had both virtues and faults. They showed remarkable ingenuity in areas like astronomy and architecture, yet lacked important cultural advances like the plow, the wheel, and sailing ships. Some tribes had no clue what a war was. Others lived and died for little else. Some Native Americans were environmentally conscious. Others were eco-clueless. Although different tribes and cultures sometimes traded with one another for necessities, they generally kept to themselves, unless they were fighting one another. Groups tended to refer to themselves as human beings or the people, and referred to other groups as simply others or something less flattering. But it wasn't character traits, good or bad, that ultimately hurt Native Americans. Instead, it was a conspiracy of other elements, an unwillingness or inability to unite against the European invader, a relatively small total population, a lack of biological defenses against European diseases, and the unfortunate tendency of many of the newcomers to view Native Americans not as human beings, but as just another exotic species in a strange new world. Visiting by the Vikings. Native Americans got their first look at what trouble was going to look like when Vikings showed up in North America. All Vikings were Norsemen, but not all Norsemen were Vikings. Viking meant to go raiding, pirating, or exploring, although some of the Scandinavians of 1,000 years ago surely did all these things, most of them stayed in Scandinavia and fished or farmed. For about 300 years, the Vikings conquered or looted much of Western Europe and Russia. In the 9th and 10th centuries, sailing in ships was made speedy and stable by the addition of keels. Consequently, the Vikings journeyed west, not so much for loot as for new lands to settle. Like many things in human history, the Vikings' first visits to the North American continent were by accident. The first sighting of the New World by a European probably occurred around 987, when a Viking named Bjarni Herolfsson sailed from Iceland to hook up with his dad and missed Greenland. Herolfsson wasn't impressed by what he saw from the ship, and he never actually set foot on land before heading back to Greenland. Herolfsson was followed about 15 years later by the son of Eric the Red, the Viking who had settled Greenland. Eric's son, Leif Erikson, was also known as Leif the Lucky. Leif landed in what's now Labrador, a part of Newfoundland, Canada. Mistaking seasonal berries for grapes, Leif called the area Vinland. He spent the winter in the new land and then left. His brother Thorvald visited Vinland the next year. Thorvald got into a fight with the local inhabitants and thus gained the distinction of being the first European to be killed by the natives in North America. Vikings called the natives Skraelings, a contemptuous term meaning dwarves. After his death, Thorvald's crew went back to Greenland. The next Viking visit was meant to be permanent, led by a brother-in-law of Leif's named Thorfinn Karlsefni. An expedition of 3 ships, some cattle, and about 160 people, including a few women, created a settlement. The Karlsefni settlement lasted 3 years. There were chronic troubles with the natives, who had a large numerical advantage, as well as weapons and fighting abilities that were equal to the Vikings. There were also too few Viking women in the settlement to keep things peaceful. So the settlers sailed back to Greenland. By 1020, most scholars agree, the Vikings had given up on North America. Supply lines to the homelands were long, the voyages back and forth were dangerous, and the natives were unfriendly. The Norsemen apparently felt that the new land wasn't worth the trouble. Remember, the Vikings' forays to the North American continent were relatively brief and had no lasting impact. The main evidence that they were even here is fairly limited. Two long sagas written in the Middle Ages, and the scattered ruins of three housing clusters and a forge at a place called Lansomedos, on the northern tip of Newfoundland. But tales of their voyages were well reported around Europe, and they served to whet the exploration appetites of people in other places. Other nations, however, plagued by troubles like, well, plagues, weren't ready to follow them west for almost 500 years. Spicing up life and other reasons for exploring. For centuries, people in Europe had no way of preserving food other than salting it, which doesn't make it very palatable. When Europeans were fighting in the Middle East during the Crusades, however, they established overland trading routes that supplied a whole condiment shelf of spices. Cinnamon from Ceylon, pepper from India, and cloves and nutmeg from the Moluccan Islands. They also developed a taste for silks from China and Japan, and they already liked the gold and precious metals of the East. But in 1453, the Turkish Empire conquered Constantinople, now Istanbul, which had been the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire and the crossroads of overland supply routes. The Turks closed the routes, and Europeans had to begin thinking about finding a sea route to reopen the trade. Countries were also putting aside the feudal disputes of the Middle Ages and unifying. In Spain, for example, 700 years of war between the Spaniards and the Moors, Arabs from North Africa, were finally over in 1492. The marriage of Ferdinand of Castile and Isabel of Aragon had united the country's two major realms, and Europe was stepping briskly toward the Renaissance. People were beginning to believe in the power of the individual to change things and were more willing to take chances. The Portuguese, the best navigators and sailors in the world at that time, except perhaps for the Polynesians, were pushing farther into the Atlantic and down the coast of Africa. In 1488, the Portuguese explorer, Bartolomeu Dias, reached the tip of Africa, named it the Cape of Good Hope, and verified that a sea route to India did exist. Meanwhile, other explorers who knew the earth was a sphere were thinking about reaching the Indies by the east by sailing west across the Atlantic. One of them was named Columbus. Christopher Columbus was obsessive, religious, stubborn, arrogant, charming, and egotistical. He was physically striking, with reddish-blonde hair that had turned white by the time he was 30, and he stood 6 feet tall at a time when most adult males were 6 inches shorter. Born the son of a weaver in Genoa, Italy in 1451, Columbus became a first-class sailor. He also ran a successful map-making business with his brother Bartholomew. But he became convinced his ticket to fame and fortune was in finding a western route to the Indies. Starting in the 1480s, Columbus and his brother began making the rounds of European capitals, looking for ships and financial backing for his idea. His demands were exorbitant. In return for his services, Columbus wanted the title Admiral of the Oceans, 10% of all the loot he found, and the ability to pass governorship of every country he discovered to his heirs. The rulers of England and France said no thanks, as did some of the city-states that made up Italy. The King of Portugal also told him to scram. so in 1486, Columbus went to Spain. Queen Isabella listened to his pitch, and she also said no, for the time being. But she did appoint a commission to look into the idea and decided to put Columbus on the payroll in the meantime. The meantime stretched out for 6 years. Finally, convinced she wasn't really risking much because chances were that he wouldn't return, Isabella gave her approval in January 1492. Columbus was on his way. Remember, partly because of error and partly because of wishful thinking, Columbus estimated the distance to the Indies at approximately 2,500 miles, which was about 7,500 miles short. But after a voyage of about 5 weeks, he and his crews, totaling 90 men, did find land at around 2 a.m. on October 12, 1492. It was an island in the Bahamas, which he called San Salvador. The timing of the discovery was good. It came even as the crews of the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria were muttering about a mutiny. Columbus dubbed the locals Indians, believing he was in the Indian Ocean. The name stuck. Columbus next sailed to Cuba, where he found few spices and little gold. Sailing on to an island he called Hispaniola, today's Dominican Republic and Haiti, the Santa Maria hit a reef on Christmas Eve, 1492. Columbus abandoned the ship, set up a trading outpost he called Navidad, left some men to operate it, and sailed back to Spain in his other two ships. So enthusiastically did people greet the news of his return that on his second voyage to Hispaniola, Columbus had 17 ships and more than 1,200 men. But this time, he ran into more than a little disappointment. Natives had wiped out his trading post after his men became too grabby with the local gold and the local women. Worse, most of the men he brought with him had come only for gold and other riches, and they didn't care about setting up a permanent colony. Because of the lack of treasures, they soon wanted to go home, and the natives lost interest in the newcomers after the novelty of the Spanish trinkets wore off. Consequently, Columbus took harsh measures. He demanded tribute in gold, which the Indians didn't have. He also divided up the land on Hispaniola and enslaved the natives, thousands of whom died. And he hanged some of the settlers for rebelling against his authority. The third and fourth voyages of Columbus also failed to produce the fabulous riches he had hoped for. When he died in 1506, he was largely considered a failure. But even if Columbus was unaware that he never reached the Orient, he knew he had not failed. "By the divine will," he said shortly before his death, "I have placed under the sovereignty of the king and queen an other world, whereby Spain, which was considered poor, is to become the richest of all countries." A cigar a day keeps the doctor away. Of all the fabulous tales Columbus's men brought back to Europe, one of the strangest was about how many Indians had this weird habit of sticking dried leaves in a slingshot-shaped pipe called a tabaco and lighting it on fire. They then put the forked end of the pipe in their nostrils and inhaled. Another method was to roll the leaves into a big tube, light one end, put the other end in their mouths, and breathe in. Columbus's men brought some of the plant seeds, which they called tobacco, back to Spain with them, and they soon spread to other parts of Europe. In France, a leading distributor was a guy named Jean Nicot, hence the word nicotine to describe the key ingredient in tobacco. Europe marveled at the miracle herb, which was believed to help heal sword wounds, ward off plague, and help clear congested lungs. Not everyone, however, was in love with the stuff. Smoking tobacco is loathsome to the eye, hateful to the nose, harmful to the brain, dangerous to the lungs, fumed England's King James I in 1604. Forsooth, he knew whereof he spoke. Could have been worse. Could have been Vespucci. Amerigo Vespucci was an Italian who settled in Spain and helped supply Columbus's voyages. He then took several trips to South America under the command of one of Columbus's captains. In 1504, somewhat exaggerated letters by Vespucci about what he called Mundus Novus, the New World, were printed throughout Europe. A German mapmaker read the letters, was impressed, and decided in 1507 to call the massive new lands on his maps America, in Vespucci's honor, which is why we're not called the United States of Christopher. Dropping names of others who dropped by. Remember in school when your history teacher would give you a sheet with a list of 15th century explorers' names on one side and a list of their accomplishments on the other side, and you had to match them up? Well, here's that list again. But before I sum up these people in a line or two, it may be a good idea to marvel at what they did. They sailed across unknown stretches of water in cramped, leaky ships no longer than a tennis court, provisioned with food that would gag a starving pig, and commanded crews who were more than willing to cut their throats if things went wrong. When they reached the Americas, they wandered for months, sometimes years, through strange lands populated by people who, though not always hostile, were certainly unpredictable. And then they had to try to get home again to tell someone about what they'd found. Although their motives were rarely pure, they displayed a lot of courage and determination. Here are 8 of these daring explorers. John Cabot, England. An Italian, Cabot was commissioned by King Henry VII to explore the New World. Using the old Viking northern route, Cabot sailed to Newfoundland in 1497, saw lots of fish, and claimed the area for England. In 1498, he took a second trip with 5 ships, but only one ever returned to England. The other ships and their crews, including Cabot, disappeared. Even so, Cabot may have been the first non-Viking European to set foot on what's now the continental United States, and he gave England its first real claim on America. Vasco Núñez de Balboa, Spain. Balboa is credited with being the first European to see the South Seas from the New World. He named it the Pacific because it appeared to be so calm. He was later beheaded by a successor to the governorship of Panama. Ferdinand Magellan. Magellan, a Portuguese explorer who was one of the greatest sailors ever, led a Spanish expedition of 5 ships in 1519. He was looking for a quick passage to the east from Europe. He sailed around the tip of South America and into the Pacific. Magellan was killed by natives in the Philippines, but one of his 5 ships made it back to Spain in 1522, the first to sail around the world. Jacques Cartier, France. He made 2 trips to the New World in 1534 and 1535, sailing up the St. Lawrence River. He went back in 1541 with a sizable expedition to look for gold and precious stones, but returned to France with what turned out to be just a bunch of quartz. Still, his trips helped France establish a claim for much of what is now Canada. Francisco Coronado, Spain. This guy led an incredible expedition in 1540 that went looking for the 7 cities of Cibola, which were supposedly dripping with riches. Instead, in 2 years of looking for the elusive cities, Coronado's group explored Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, and the Gulf of California, and discovered the Grand Canyon. But they never found gold. Hernando de Soto, Spain. He marched around what are now the Gulf states before discovering the Mississippi River in 1541. He died of a fever on its banks. Samuel de Champlain, France. A mapmaker, Champlain landed in the New World in 1603 and explored extensively in the northeastern part of the continent. He founded the colony of Quebec in 1608. Henry Hudson, Netherlands. Hudson sailed up the bay and river that now bear his name in present-day New York in 1609. He was looking for a northwest passage to the Indies. Instead, he found an area rich in fur-bearing mammals and helped the Dutch lay claim to a piece of the continent. He was cast adrift by his crew in a mutiny in 1611 and was never heard from again. The sword, the cross, and the measles. One of the problems in discovering a new land that's already inhabited is deciding how to interact with the people who got there first. When it came to the Native American populations of the New World, the Europeans generally decided on fighting with them or enslaving them. Native American slavery. It started with Columbus. By his second voyage to Hispaniola, he set up a system called the encomienda, which amounted to slavery. Under it, a colonist who was given a piece of land had the right to the labor of all the natives who lived on that land, whether they were interested in a job or not. Columbus also imposed a gold tax on the Indians and sometimes cut the hands off of those who couldn't or wouldn't pay it. Between slavery, killings, and diseases, the population of Hispaniola's natives plummeted from an estimated 250,000 to 300,000 at the time of Columbus's arrival in 1492 to perhaps 60,000 by 1510 to near zero by 1550. As the Indians on the main islands died off, the Spanish settlers in the Caribbean simply raided other, smaller islands and kidnapped the residents there. A historian at the time wrote that you could navigate among islands without compass or chart simply by following the trail of dead Indians who had been thrown from ships. When even the populations of the little islands waned, the Spanish looked for other cheap labor sources. They found them in Africa. African slaves were first imported to the New World within a few years after Columbus's first trip. By 1513, King Carlos I of Spain had given his royal assent to the African slave trade. He made his decision in part, he said, to improve the lot of the Indians. Of course, the fact that many Spanish landholders in the New World were beginning to prefer African slaves made his decision easier. They believed the Africans had better immunity to European diseases and were more used to hard agricultural labor because they came from agricultural cultures. The men in the brown robes. Whatever his other motives, King Carlos I and his successors did have their consciences regularly pricked by some church leaders, as well as missionaries who accompanied the early voyagers. In 1514, Pope Leo X declared that not only the Christian religion, but nature cries out against the slavery and the slave trade. In 1537, Pope Paul III declared Indians were not to be enslaved. Remember, with 21st-century hindsight, it's tempting to shrug off the work of the early European missionaries as sort of a PR effort designed to make the nastier things the conquerors did look less nasty. Although the idea that the cross was used to justify bad treatment of the heathens has some truth, a 1513 proclamation required natives to convert or be enslaved or executed, most of the people who committed the worst atrocities apparently didn't much care who knew about their violent actions. Thus, they didn't need an excuse. The horrendous actions of some of their fellow Europeans certainly didn't make the missionaries' jobs easier. One Native American chief who was being burned at the stake by government officials, not missionaries, for refusing to convert, reportedly replied that he feared if he did join the religion, he might go to heaven and meet only Christians. And for the serious sweet tooth. On his second trip to the Americas in 1493, Columbus stopped by the Canary Islands and picked up some sugarcane cuttings. He planted them in Hispaniola, and they thrived. In 1516, the first sugar grown in the New World was presented to King Carlos I of Spain. By 1531, it was as commercially important to the Spanish colonial economy as gold. Planters soon discovered a byproduct as well. The juice left over after the sugar was pressed out of the cane and crystallized was called molasses by the Spanish and molasses by the English. Mixing this juice with water and leaving it out in the sun created a potent and tasty fermented drink. They called it rum, perhaps after the Latin word for sugar cane, Saccharum officinarum. The stuff was great for long sea voyages because it didn't go bad. Sugar and rum became so popular that sugar plantations mushroomed all over the Caribbean. Destruction through disease. If they managed to survive slavery, the sword, and the excesses committed in the name of the cross, the New World's natives were then likely candidates to die from the Europeans' most formidable weapon, disease. Because they had never been exposed to them as a culture, the Native Americans' immune systems had no defense when faced with diseases such as measles and smallpox. The first major epidemic, smallpox, started in 1518 after the disease arrived at Hispaniola via a shipload of colonists. From there, it gradually and sporadically spread through North, Central, and South America by following the Native Americans' trade and travel routes. Sometimes, disease spread so fast that it decimated tribes before they ever saw a European. Some historians believe that disease was spread less by the Europeans and more by the livestock they brought with them, particularly the pigs. The theory is that the pigs passed on microbes to the native wildlife, allowing disease to spread more quickly than it could have by mere human transmission. What's certain is that over the next 400 years, smallpox, measles, whooping cough, typhus, and scarlet fever killed thousands of times more Native Americans than guns or swords did. A pox on the conquerors. New World Native Americans may have gathered a measure of revenge in the disease department by giving Europeans syphilis. Many researchers believe that Columbus's sailors brought the disease back to Spain from the Americas, where it was relatively common among different Native American groups. The theory was bolstered in early 2008 when a study led by Emory University scientist Kristen Harper determined through molecular genetics that the sexually transmitted version of the disease originated in the New World. In 1495, after Columbus returned from his first voyage, the rulers of Spain and France sent large armies to besiege the Italian city of Naples. After the city was captured, the soldiers returned and helped to spread the new venereal disease. The French called it the Neapolitan disease, and the Spanish called it the French disease. They proved that there are some new things for which no nation wants credit. Arriving late for the party. Spain's early explorations of the New World gave that country a great head start over its European rivals. Spanish conquerors defeated mighty empires in Mexico and Peru, the Aztecs and the Incas. Both empires had huge caches of gold and silver and sophisticated cultures with built-in labor classes. All the Spanish had to do was kill the old bosses and become the new bosses, so they didn't have to import slaves as they had done in the Caribbean. Moreover, the conquests spawned a herd of adelantados, or advancers, who roamed all over the lower half of America in search of the next big empire. But Spain's position of preeminence was short-lived. In 1588, Spanish plans to invade England with an armada of ships blew up when the fleet was scattered by the English navy and a fierce storm. Within 30 years, both England and France had established colonies in the New World. Eventually, a growing spirit of independence would strip Spain of its New World empire. Early on, it was pretty clear that war-weary Europe would soon be fighting again over the spoils of the New World. In an effort to head that off, and also find a way to put his mark of authority over matters in the Americas. Pope Alexander VI divided the Americas between Spain and Portugal by drawing a line on the map. This decision left Portugal with what's now Brazil, Spain with everything else, and the rest of Europe pretty peeved. King Henry VII of England declared that he would ignore the papal edict. King Francis I of France sniffed, "We failed to find this clause in Adam's will." The countries left empty-handed by the Pope's decree got over it in part by picking off Spanish ships laden with treasure on their way home. France. Throughout much of the 16th century, France's efforts to get its share of the Americas were marred by civil wars and inept leadership. The French forays to the New World were limited to fishermen who came each year to mine the cod-rich banks off Newfoundland and explorations of areas that are now New England and eastern Canada. Moreover, while the Spanish were in it for the loot and the English for the land, the French weren't quite sure what they wanted. They eventually settled on a little of both. Fur franchises were awarded private companies on the condition that they also start permanent colonies. But the companies didn't try very hard, and as the 1500s ended, the French had little more than a tenuous hold on its New World dominion. England. Despite early explorations by John Cabot just on the heels of Columbus's voyages, England lagged behind Spain when it came to exploring and exploiting the New World. Part of the problem was that the English were broke, and part of it was that England feared Spain's military might. By the end of the 16th century, however, the English were encouraged by the successive raids against Spanish American cities and ships by privateers, a cross between patriots and pirates, such as John Hawkins and Francis Drake. The defeat in 1588 of the Spanish Armada, the invasion fleet that met with disaster off the coast of England, encouraged England even more. In 1587, Walter Raleigh, who had the royal right to colonize in the Americas, sent a group that consisted of 89 men, 7 women, and 11 children to what is now North Carolina. They called their colony Roanoke. Unfortunately, the looming threat of the Spanish invasion meant the little colony got no support from the homeland. In 1590, when a relief expedition finally arrived, the colonists had vanished. They left behind only rotting and rummaged junk and a single word carved in a tree, Croatoan. The word referred to an island about 100 miles south of Roanoke. No one knows the meaning behind the carved word, and no one knows exactly what happened to the first English colony in the New World. Chapter 3. Pilgrim's Progress, the English Colonies, 1607 to 1700. In this chapter, looking to the New World for a fresh start. Settling and colonizing, different strokes for different folks. Setting slavery in motion. Relating to the Native Americans, mostly negatively. With the defeat of the Spanish naval armada off the coast of England in 1588, Spain seemed to lose interest in expanding its empire in the New World. England, on the other hand, was eager to make up for lost time. In this chapter, England establishes its American colonies, slavery establishes itself as an enduring evil, and colonists wrestle with religious differences among themselves and with Native Americans over nearly everything else. Seeing potential in the New World. For most of the 16th century, England was too poor and too timid to do much about the opportunities presented by the opening of two new continents. By 1604, however, when England and Spain signed a tenuous peace treaty, the English had good reasons to think about branching out to the new lands of the West. Among them were economic incentive. A middle class of merchants, speculators, and entrepreneurs had formed, By pooling their resources in joint stock companies, these capitalists could invest in schemes to make money in the New World by backing colonists who would produce goods England and the rest of Europe wanted. They could also harvest resources, such as timber, for which England had to depend on other Old World countries. Overpopulation. Even though the entire population of about 4 million was less than half that of modern-day London, many Englishmen pined for a less crowded land. Religious dissent. Protestantism, a rival Christian religion to the one led by the Pope in Rome, had developed in the 16th century and become firmly rooted in England. Even though the country's own state church was Protestant, many English Protestants felt it wasn't different enough from the Roman Catholic faith they had left. Religiously restless, they looked to America as a place to plant the seeds of their own version of Christianity. Wool. England's woolen industry was booming in the late 1500s and early 1600s. Farms were turned into pastures for more and more sheep, and the tenant farmers on the former farms were forced off with no particular place to go, except the New World. Settling in Jamestown. It's pretty safe to say that the first permanent English colony in America was put together about as well as a soup sandwich. Those who set out to establish the colony weren't sure where they were going or what to do when they got there. A group of investors known as the Virginia Company of London was given a charter by King James I to settle somewhere in the southern part of the New World area known as Virginia. After a voyage on which roughly 27% of the original 144 settlers died, three ships arrived at the mouth of a river they ingratiatingly named the James after the king. On May 14, 1607, they began the settlement of Jamestown. Early troubles. Some of the settlers were indentured servants who had traded 7 years of their labor for passage to America. Most of the others were far more interested in finding gold than creating a colony and lacked skills, such as hunting or farming, that might actually be useful in the wilderness. As one historian put it, it was a colony of people who wouldn't work or couldn't. Worse, the site they had chosen for a settlement was in a malaria-ridden swamp, and the local inhabitants were both suspicious and unfriendly. In fact, the Native Americans launched their first attack against the newcomers within 2 weeks of their arrival. Within 6 months, half of the 105 settlers who had survived the trip were dead of disease or starvation. Making Native American friends. Those who did survive did so largely because of a character named John Smith. An experienced and courageous adventurer, Smith was also a shameless self-promoter and a world-class liar, with a knack for getting into trouble. On the voyage over, for example, he was charged with mutiny, although he was eventually acquitted. But whatever his faults, Smith was both gutsy and diplomatic. He managed to make friends with Powhatan, the chief of the local Native Americans, and the tribe provided the colonists with enough food to hold on. Smith provided much-needed leadership, declaring, "He that will not work, neither shall he eat." Without Smith, the colony may not have survived. As it was, Jamestown came pretty close to disaster. In the winter of 1609, called the Starving Time, conditions got so bad colonists resorted to eating anything they could get, including each other. One man was executed after eating the body of his dead wife. In 1610, the survivors were actually on a ship and ready to head home when a military relief expedition showed up and took charge. Finding a cash crop. One of the biggest problems the colonists faced was coming up with a product that people in England wanted and which could form the basis of a profitable economy. They found one in 1613, when a fellow named John Rolfe developed a variety of tobacco that was a huge hit in the mother country. Within a few years, Jamestown had a thriving cash crop. Remember, In 1619, three things happened in the Virginia colony that had a large impact on the British in America. One was the arrival of 90 women, who became the brides of settlers who paid for their passage at a cost of 120 pounds of tobacco each. The second was the meeting of the first legislative body of colonists on the continent, known as the House of Burgesses. It met for about a week, passed laws against gambling and idleness, and decreed all colonists must attend two church services each Sunday and bring their weapons with them. Then the legislators adjourned because it was too hot to keep meeting. The third event, 3 weeks after the House of Burgesses had become a symbol of representative government in the New World, was the arrival of a Dutch ship. From its cargo, Jamestown settlers bought 20 human beings from Africa to work in the tobacco fields. Instituting slavery. While it was a Dutch ship that brought the first slaves to Virginia, no European nation had a monopoly on the practice. The Portuguese were the first Europeans to raid the African coast for slaves in the mid-15th century. They were quickly followed by the Spanish, who used Africans to supplant the New World Indians who had either been killed or died of diseases. By the mid-16th century, the English sea dog John Hawkins was operating a thriving slave trade between Africa and the Caribbean. Most slaves were seized from tribes in the continent's interior and sold from West African ports to the New World. Some were hunted down by European and Arab slave traders. Many were sold by rival tribes after being captured in wars or on raids. And some were sold by their own tribes when they got into debt or ran afoul of tribal leaders. Although the use of African slaves in the tobacco fields proved successful and more slaves were gradually imported, slavery was by no means a strictly southern colony phenomenon. While the northern colonies had less use for slaves as agricultural workers, they put Africans to work as domestic servants or as unpaid laborers in various trades. One reason was that slaves represented more or less permanent labor, while indentured servants, people who traded 5 to 7 years of work in return for passage to the New World, would eventually have to be freed. Remember, not everyone in the colonies was enamored with slavery. In 1688, a radical Protestant group in Pennsylvania, known as the Mennonites, became the first American religious group to formally oppose the practice. In 1700, a New England judge named Samuel Sewall published a 3-page tract called The Selling of Joseph, in which he compared slavery to what Joseph's brothers did to him in the biblical story and called for the abolition of slavery in the colonies. But voices such as Sewall's were few and far between. Although the total population of slaves was relatively low through most of the 1600s, colonial governments took steps to institutionalize slavery. In 1662, Virginia passed a law that automatically made slaves of slaves' children. In 1664, Maryland's Assembly declared that all black people in the colony were slaves for life, whether they converted to Christianity or not. And in 1684, New York's legislators recognized slavery as a legitimate practice. As the 17th century ended, it was clear that African slaves were a much better bargain, in terms of costs, than European servants, and the number of slaves began to swell. In 1670, Virginia had a population of about 2,000 slaves. By 1708, the number was 12,000. Slavery had not only taken root, it was sprouting. Colonizing, Pilgrims and Puritans. While Virginia was being settled by gentlemen farmers, servants, slaves, and some people you wouldn't trust with your car keys, a very different kind of people were putting together England's second colony in America. These people, who settled New England, came to America for wealth of another type. They were spurred by their deep religious beliefs and their zeal to find a haven for the freedom to practice their faith, although not necessarily for anyone else to practice theirs. The Mayflower Compact, a Dutch pilgrimage. The Pilgrims, actually they called themselves the Saints and everyone else the Strangers, and they weren't dubbed Pilgrims until much later by one of their leaders, were mostly lower-class farmers and craftsmen who had decided the Church of England was still too Catholic for their tastes. So, they separated themselves from the Church, thus resulting in everyone else calling them separatists. This didn't please King James I, who suggested rather forcefully that they rejoin or separate themselves from England. The separatists did just that, settling in Holland in 1608. But after a decade of watching their children become Dutchified, the English expatriates longed for some place they could live as English subjects and still worship the way they wanted. The answer was America. After going back to England and negotiating a charter to establish a colony, taking out a few loans, and forming a company, a group of 102 men, women, and children left England on September 16, 1620, on a ship called the Mayflower. A second ship, the Speedwell, also started out but sprang a leak and had to turn back. The Mayflower was usually used for shipping wine between France and England. Its cargo for this trip was decidedly more varied than usual. Although the Pilgrims didn't really pack any smarter than had the Jamestown colonists, they did show some imagination. Among the things they took to the wilderness of North America were musical instruments, all kinds of furniture, and even books on the history of Turkey, the country, not the bird. One guy even brought 139 pairs of shoes and boots. Despite a rough crossing that took 65 days, only one passenger and four crewmen died, and one child was born. After some preliminary scouting, they dropped anchor in a broad, shallow bay known as Plymouth. No evidence exists to indicate they landed on any kind of rock. Remember, two important things happened on the way over. One was that the Pilgrims missed their turnoff and failed to land within the borders laid out by their charter. That meant they were essentially squatters and didn't fall under the direct governance of anyone in England. Secondly, concerned by mutterings from some members of the group that they should go home, the colony's leaders drew up a compact, or set of rules, by which they all agreed to abide. This became known as the Mayflower Compact. The Mayflower Compact was remarkable in that it was drawn up by people who were essentially equal to one another and were looking for a way to establish laws they could all live under. Although it certainly left out equal rights for women, slaves, Native Americans, and indentured servants, it was still a key early step in the colonists' journey toward self-rule and independence from England. Despite their planning, the Plymouth colony had a very rough first winter. Just like the Jamestown colonists, half the Plymouth settlers died in the first 6 months. But unlike many of the Jamestown colonists, the Pilgrims were hard workers. They had an extremely able leader in William Bradford, who was to be governor of the colony for more than 30 years, and an able, although diminutive, military leader in Miles Standish. His nickname was Captain Shrimp. They were also extremely lucky because the local Native Americans proved not only to be great neighbors, but also had one among them who spoke English. The locals showed the newcomers some planting techniques and then traded the colonists' furs for corn, which gave the Pilgrims something to send back to England. By the fall of 1622, the Plymouth colonists had much to be thankful for. The Plymouth colony never got all that big, and by 1691 it was absorbed by the larger Massachusetts Bay Colony. But the impact of its approach to government and its effect on the American psyche far outstripped its size or longevity. Ever since, greatly aided by countless elementary school Thanksgiving pageants, the Pilgrims have dominated most Americans' images of the country's earliest settlers. Squanto. His real name was Tisquantum, and he was a member of the Pawtuxet tribe. In 1605, Squanto was taken to England, possibly as a slave, by a passing explorer named George Weymouth. In 1613, he returned to the New World as a guide for Captain John Smith and remained there. A short time later, however, Squanto was abducted by yet another English expedition and sold as a slave in Spain. This time, he escaped. He made his way to England and eventually onto a 1619 expedition to New England, only to find his tribe had been exterminated by disease, most probably brought by the white newcomers. So, when the pilgrims arrived, Squanto spoke fluent English, a little Spanish, and was essentially rootless. He was also apparently extremely tolerant. Until he died a little more than a year after their arrival, Squanto stayed with the pilgrims, acting as their interpreter and advisor. Talk about a good sport! Thanks a Drumstick. When the first Thanksgiving feast took place is uncertain, but it was probably between September 21st and November 9th, 1621. Under a decree by Governor William Bradford, Chief Massasoit and his Wampanoag tribe were invited to share a few days' worth of wild fowl, venison, leeks, watercress, plums, berries, eels, oysters, cornbread, and popped corn. It was such a good idea that only 242 years later, President Abraham Lincoln made it a national holiday. The Massachusetts Bay Colony, a pure haven. It's easy to confuse the Pilgrims and the Puritans. Both groups moved to journey to America for religious reasons. Both were remarkably intolerant of other people's beliefs, and neither was much fun at parties. But they had differences. The Puritans were less radical and less interested in leaving the Church of England than in purifying it. Their leader was a well-to-do lawyer named John Winthrop. He had some qualities that came to be a part of the stereotypical New England Yankee. He was deeply religious, but a practical businessman. He advocated and put into practice such egalitarian principles as trial by jury, yet regarded democracy as the meanest and worst of all forms of government. Armed with a charter that gave the colonists extraordinary independence in making their own rules, Winthrop led about 500 Puritans to the Massachusetts Bay Colony in New England in 1630, establishing the city of Boston later that year. An even larger group of Puritans had settled at Salem, in another part of the colony, the year before, and by 1642, as many as 20,000 Puritans had left England for America. The Puritans established fur, fishing, and shipbuilding industries. They set up a system of compulsory free education, institutions of higher learning, and a model for what would eventually become a typical two-house state government in America. They developed crafts such as silversmithing and printed their own books. They were also pretty puritanical. Religious dissidents, especially Quakers, were routinely beaten and banished, and sometimes hanged. If they beat the gospel black and blue, one Puritan minister said in explaining this treatment, it is but just to beat them black and blue. Adultery was punishable by death until 1632, when the penalty was reduced to a public whipping and the forced wearing of the letters A.D. sewed onto the clothing. Remember, the impact of the Puritan society of New England was huge. In it were the roots of the modern corporate system, the representative form of state and federal government, the American legal system, and the moral conflict between wanting the freedom to think and act as you please and the authority to control how others think and act. Which is which? Witch hunting in America started with kids fooling around. It ended with 20 executions and a wave of hysteria that swept through New England. In early 1692, three young girls in Salem, Massachusetts, threw fits and claimed they had been bewitched by a West Indian slave and two other local women. The accusations begat more accusations as the girls and their friends basked in the attention. When they admitted they had made it up, it was too late. Witchcraft accusations were used to settle all sorts of petty personal and political scores. By the time Governor William Phipps, whose own wife was accused, had put an end to it, 150 people had been charged with consorting with Satan. Of that number, 28 were convicted, 5 confessed and were released, 2 escaped, 1 pardoned, and 20, 14 women and 6 men, were executed. All the women and 5 of the men were hanged. One man, who refused to speak at his trial, was pressed to death under heavy stones. Despite widespread belief to the contrary, none was burned at the stake, as witches were commonly dealt with in Europe. Bringing religious freedom, dissidents, Catholics, and Quakers. The Massachusetts and Jamestown colonies were only the beginning. Throughout the rest of the 17th century, English settlers of all kinds moved to America. Some of those didn't like where they landed, or the place they landed didn't like them. But it was a big country, so they began the American tradition of moving on. Some of the colonies, Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and North and South Carolina, were either privately founded or were offshoots of the Massachusetts and Virginia colonies. But 3 of them had very different beginnings. Sneaking off to Rhode Island. In 1633, a smart and sociable guy named Roger Williams became a minister in Salem, Massachusetts. He also became an expert in Native American languages and was troubled by the way his fellow settlers treated the natives. His fellow settlers, meanwhile, were troubled by Williams' insistence that land shouldn't be stolen from the Native Americans and that there should be a separation between the institutions of church and state. So troubling was this latter idea to Puritan leaders that they decided to ship the troublemaker back to England. But Williams was tipped off to the plan by John Winthrop, and with the help of friendly Native Americans, Williams and his family slipped off in 1636 to an unsettled area. By 1644, it had become the colony of Rhode Island. Small and disliked by its neighbors, Rhode Island became a haven for those seeking religious freedom, or those who just plain didn't like life in the rest of Puritan New England. No persons in this country shall be molested or questioned for the matters of his conscience to God, so he be loyal and keep the civil peace, Williams said. Forced worship stinks in God's nostrils. Collecting Catholics in Maryland. While the Puritans may have had some religious differences among themselves, they did agree on one thing. They didn't like Roman Catholics. Undaunted, Catholics established a colony north of Virginia in 1634. Called Maryland, it was the result of a grant given by King James I to his former secretary, George Calvert, who had converted to Catholicism. The colony prospered as a tobacco exporter, but so many Protestants were allowed in that its Catholic founders were threatened with the prospect of being persecuted in their own colony. So, they struck a compromise in 1649, which recognized all Christian religions and decreed the death penalty for Jews and atheists. Promoting tolerance in Pennsylvania. If Puritans didn't like Catholics, they really didn't like Quakers. Quakers, who referred to themselves as friends, were steadfast pacifists who had no paid clergy, refused to use titles or take oaths of allegiance, and were said to quake from deep religious emotion. In 1681, a wealthy Quaker named William Penn got a charter to start a colony in America. He advertised it exhaustively, attracted a diverse group of settlers, and founded Pennsylvania. Penn treated the Native Americans fairly, set up a relatively liberal system of laws, and made it easy for most people to settle in his colony. By 1700, Pennsylvania's leading city, Philadelphia, was, after Boston, the colony's leading cultural center. Penn died in poverty and in social and political disrepute. But more than any other colony, Pennsylvania was truly tolerant of differing religions, cultures, and national backgrounds. Dealings of the Dutch. While the English, French, and Spanish were noisily tromping all over the New World, the Dutch were establishing themselves as the most successful maritime traders in the Old World. Intent on getting their share of the American trade, they formed the Dutch West India Company, and in 1626 established a colony in the New World at the mouth of the Hudson River, calling it New Amsterdam. Three other settlements added up to a colony the Dutch called New Netherland. New Amsterdam was different from the New England settlements in that it wasn't founded for religious reasons. So its attitude was more relaxed when it came to activities like drinking and gambling. In addition, land for the colonists wasn't an issue because New Amsterdam